Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the release today of a report from the U.S. Global Change Research Program that says climate change is no longer a distant threat, but a clear and present danger. Dr. Brenda Eckwessel, who leads the Union of Concerned Scientists' climate science education and policy work, joins us from the White House where the report was released today. We will discuss the report that offers global and regional current and anticipated impacts of climate change on infrastructure, agriculture, human health, and access to water. Then we'll look into what help the U.S. might be offering the Nigerian government in its faltering effort to retrieve over 200 schoolgirls captured by Boko Haram, whose leader is threatening to turn the girls into slaves. One of the few Westerners to have met with the murderous Boko Haram insurgents, Eliza Griswold, who wrote about her encounter in her book, The Tenth Parallel, Dispatches from the Fault Line Between Islam and Christianity, joins us to discuss the corrupt Nigerian government's inability to protect its own citizens, most of whom live in dire poverty, while government officials steal billions from the country's oil wealth. And we'll also discuss her article at Slate, Why Fear Boko Haram? Then finally, we will speak with a 24-year veteran Foreign Service officer at the State Department, Peter Van Buren, about the urgent need for a diplomatic effort to prevent a war in Ukraine. He spent a year in Iraq leading two State Department provincial reconstruction teams, which he wrote about in a book, We Meant Well, How I Helped Lose the Battle for the Hearts and Minds of the Iraqi People, which resulted in him being fired and stripped of his security clearance and diplomatic credentials. We will discuss the White House's efforts to punish Putin by preventing American business leaders from attending a gathering Putin has organized, a move that puts the business leaders in a no-win situation of either offending the White House or Putin, who might punish them by killing their deals in Russia. And joining us now is Dr. Brenda Eckwessel, who is a climate scientist from the Union of Concerned Scientists. She is leading the Union of Concerned Scientists' climate science education work aimed at strengthening support for strong federal climate legislation and sound U.S. climate policies. Her specialty is isotope geochemistry, a tool she has used to study climate variability in places as disparate as the Arctic Ocean and the desert southwest. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Brenda Eckwessel.
Thank you so much. It's good to be with you.
And Brenda, you're actually at the White House. You've been in a meeting, and we're just catching you on the way out after they've handed back your cell phone. Tell me what went on in the meeting, because obviously we're talking to you today because the White House has released a new study from the U.S. Global Change Research Program saying that climate change is no longer a distant threat, but a real and present danger.
Absolutely. It was quite fanfare for the release today. Essentially, Congress requested an assessment of the climate change impacts in the United States, and today the president delivered this report. And it confirms what Americans are already seeing with their own eyes, that the seas are rising, that the punishing heat waves are upon us, the heaviest rain events are getting heavier, and drought more severe. And so this is something that is clear and palpable, the amount of attention that the White House is paying to this report that has what we consider actionable science.
But this is a report that's supposed to be issued at least every 4 years under the Global Change Research Act of 1990. But during the Bush administration, they tried to tamper with the report. So clearly, this issue is still somewhat mired in politics.
What's different about this report is that the transparency and the process and the openness of the process and understanding the science behind these assessment key findings, you can dig deeper in the report if you want to see all the decisions that were made. And the transparency is unparalleled of any national climate assessment that I've seen before. The leadership to make this a much more comprehensive report on that standpoint because of the history is of note, and more importantly, it is very clear to understand what's in the report because people on the ground are trying to protect their local communities, and there's information that really drills down to regional levels and gives examples of folks who are trying to protect their communities for the consequences of climate change.
So do you expect then the usual suspects to come out of the denial lobby, or is this sufficient, do you think, since it's literally giving tools to those on the ground in state and local government to start dealing with this issue? I mean, I take it we're not talking about, you know, stopping climate change anymore. We're talking about adapting to it and trying to mediate it.
Well, there was also a lot of emphasis on the steps to slow the pace of climate change by reducing the emissions from America and the steps that are being taken to increase fuel economy standards, looking at the EPA to use the Clean Air Act and reduce emissions from the power plant sector in the United States, as well as looking at international opportunities as well. So it's a multi-pronged effort to try to use all the tools that the administration has at its disposal to act without needing any additional effort from Congress. Of course, to really, as you say, really make a difference, we do need to have Congress to jump into the fray, understand that the science is clear, climate change is real, it's here now, and it's primarily from burning fossil fuels, which makes it very clear the types of actions that need to be taken.
So given that the report indicates that if emissions continue to rise, temperatures on the very hottest days during the last 20 years of this century may be 10 degrees to 15 degrees hotter across most of the country. We already have a severe drought here in the state of California. The areas most affected are represented by Republican Congress people. So I'm just curious to know whether, you know, the reality on the ground is going to change this peculiar atavistic dogma that's out there in terms of denial.
Well, it's very interesting. At the release today, we had an official from Southeast Florida who talked about Republicans in the state of Florida and Republican mayors in some of the counties and cities, as well as Democratic mayor down there. And yet, when it comes to, as she said, when people are dealing with their streets being flooded during a high tide because the sewage system and the drainage infrastructure is really just a gateway for high tide to come flooding into the streets during a sunny day in Florida, no raindrop around, they know they have a problem and they're calling City Hall and say, do something. And it is totally nonpartisan at the local level. You have to help residents that are dealing with climate change on the ground. And that helped people in that region to realize that they had to get beyond the partisan politics and really start working together and to compete for initiatives to try to get grants to help solve the problems that they're facing there. And California, this is a record drought, and there may be a possibility if the natural cycles go back into an El Nino that there might be some relief with the rain. If it doesn't develop into a strong El Nino, we need to have every tool at our disposal to help with the farmers and ranchers who are dealing with this drought. The food that comes on America's tables are going to be more costly. Drinking water in Southern California to power our electricity system across the nation, we need access to lots of water resources. And one of the findings of the report is that it said that one of the obstacles is that the laws of the nation to deal with water resources, which in drought-prone areas is of acute concern, they have a stationarity principle that we want to restore to what it was before. But the past is no longer necessarily what we're going to face today or even in the future.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. Brenda Eckwessel, who is a climate scientist from the Union of Concerned Scientists. She is leading the Union of Concerned Scientists' climate science education work aimed at strengthening support for strong federal climate legislation and sound U.S. climate policies. Her specialty is isotope geochemistry, a tool she's used to study climate variability in places as disparate as the Arctic Ocean and the desert southwest. And she is just leaving the White House now, having been at a meeting at the White House today, where the new report from the U.S. Global Change Research Program was released. And this was a report that was generated by a 60-person advisory committee comprised of government, private, and academic representatives who oversaw the assessments, which took 4 years and involved more than 300 scientists, engineers, and technical experts. So in terms of what we were just talking about, here in California, of course, with the water crisis and this drought that you were suggesting, there may be some good news. On the other hand, it may go on for years, and water will have to be dealt with and rationed. And, you know, we've always had this competition in California between water for people's lawns in the cities and for agribusiness in the big central area of the coast, where so much of the country's fruits and vegetables are grown. Now we also find that our limited water supplies are being in competition with enormous amounts of water that it need for fracking, particularly in the Monterey Shale area. So there's a lot of competition growing for less and less water.
Water is very, very key resource that many people need. And in California, at the end of the pipeline, so to speak, with Colorado River flowing out of the diminishing water resources to the region, because at the time the Colorado River Compact was signed, it had very, very record high flows for the most recent, say, 150-year history, and they happened to sign the compact using the flow at that time, and it hasn't really been that high since. And so the states have to reallocate that water and make decisions about who gets the water. And therefore, many resource planners are looking for other ways to better conserve the water and to make better decisions so that everyone can meet the needs. And water is not something that you want to use in a wasteful way, and fracking certainly does need a lot of water.
So in terms of the Northeast, they've had a 71% increase in storms, you know, including the superstorm Sandy, which did enormous damage. So what was the sense then of, you mentioned Florida, seawater coming into the sewage system. We've talked about California, the battle for water, and the possibility of a long and crippling drought. What was the sense of, again, how the Northeast is going to face this ongoing situation? Because as I was saying earlier, Brenda, it seems to me that we've passed the point of, well, obviously there's much to be done to try and stop global warming, but at this point, aren't we also talking about mitigating its effects?
We do have to prepare and protect ourselves from the consequences of climate change that we already can't avoid, because we've already, from our historic emissions, locked in a certain amount of climate change that we're struggling with and dealing with now. And in order to really avoid some of the worst consequences and to slow the pace of future climate change, to give communities more time to plan and prepare, we do need to dramatically reduce emissions, because we've only just had a taste of the changes that are in store for us if we were to continue unabated.
And is there a sense then that, I mean, obviously this is a global problem, not an American problem, although the industrial West has put up most of the stuff that's up there now, but China and India are coming on. And what was the discussions in the White House about the U.S.'s responsibility to do what it can vis-a-vis a more effective way, which would be for the entire world to cooperate? I mean, I see this as such a problem that I think we need a new form of global patriotism, that we all, as a species on this planet, should band together to protect this planet that's endangered.
We did hear encouraging words at the White House today that essentially the recognition that we have to get our own house in order in the United States, reduce our own emissions, meet targets that are set in all energy structures, in the ways we produce energy, how we use energy. And in 2012, we did reduce the emissions of heat-trapping gases in the United States, which was a good feat. And in order to show leadership internationally to encourage the rest of the world's large emitters to step up and do more as well. As long as we don't have our house in order, the White House officials today were indicating that we don't have a chance of really solving this unless we bring all nations on board that really are making the most contribution to the historical emissions as well as future emissions. And so we know that emerging economies are contributing more and more to emissions. And the people who are extracting more fossil fuels in order to fire up our economies there is going to be a big change on the energy front and where we go in the future, because we know the cost of further extraction has to eventually be phased out.
So we've discussed, Brenda Ekwessel, the drought and how the snowpack is melting here in California. And, of course, this extends the wildfire season. And we already had some hot days here in Southern California just a week ago that were, you know, the worst of the fire hazards that you normally get much, much later in the year. So there's no question that things are changing. But in a very basic sense, you know, in terms of the science, my understanding is that as the big ice packs on the poles melt, and we've seen that these glaciers and these huge icebergs breaking off, that means literally that the sunlight that's reflected off the white surfaces of the pole that goes back into outer space is not happening, because more and more, as the polar ice caps shrink, therefore you have more and more dark water that absorbs the light rather than reflects it back into outer space. Is that the fundamental cycle that we're talking about here?
Absolutely. The polar regions, you have amplification of the change. For example, in the parts of the lower United States, we have changes on several degrees rise since the pre-industrial period, but Alaska has many, many more degrees rise that are projected by the end of the century, because it's up in the polar region where you have those processes you were just talking about with shrinking ice and the amplification, the polar amplification of the climate change signal, which really affects all of us, because as soon as you raise the sea level, and if you put seafood, and you buy seafood to eat during the day, then you have a connection to the coast and the sea level rise that those coastal communities are affecting, are feeling.
So I had heard at one point somebody made a suggestion, and it sounded a little off the wall, but I just wanted to run it by you, that maybe that we should paint every roof on the face of the planet white and start figuring ways to reflect light back into outer space. Does that make any sense?
Yes, there are calculations to do that. There are also other people who want to have green roofs so that you can ameliorate, try to grow as much, you know, woody vegetation and try to have as much photosynthesis going on and turn it into energy, help with runoff, or try to not have impermeable surfaces, and to help cool the roofs. So there are many different strategies out there, and all of them depend on where you live and the types of engineering structures that you have.
And is some of these ideas in this new report that we're talking
about? Yes, it has practical guidance and very very interesting case studies, and the areas it identifies opportunities in each sector, and it also identifies challenges that are out there that we do need to be careful and smart about overcoming.
So this means that the individual, in terms of what's called your global warming individual footprint or your carbon footprint, you know, so far we've sort of, you know, recycled our plastics and papers in one bin and, you know, garbage in another and the green in another, and it doesn't seem like very much. So this means that there's some serious things that individuals can do above and beyond what we've been doing so far. And of course, you know, that means buying Priuses and, you know, electric cars when you can and can afford them, and they seem to be getting cheaper. But then there are problems with batteries as well, ecologically speaking. So is there going to be a leap forward in what the individual can do?
There's only so much we can do as individuals, but we can do a lot by sending signals to businesses that we do want more efficient appliances, more efficient cars, and we want more efficient homes and buildings where we work. And that will go a long way. Energy efficiency is the low-hanging fruit. Beyond that, we do need governments. We do need Congress to step up. We do need international leaders, and we do need bilateral negotiations between countries and multilateral negotiations between the large emitters to really take a big bite out of our emissions to the atmosphere and look for the energy champions of the future.
Well, Dr. Brenda Ekwessel, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for calling attention to this important report.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Brenda Ekwessel, who is a climate scientist from the Union of Concerned Scientists. She's leading the Union of Concerned Scientists' climate science education work aimed at strengthening support for strong federal climate legislation and sound U.S. climate policies. Her specialty is isotope geochemistry, a tool she's used to study climate variability in places as disparate as the Arctic Ocean and the desert southwest. And we just spoke with her from the White House, where she'd been attending a meeting with the release of the U.S. Global Change Research Program's report. We're going to take a brief station break. We look into what U.S. help might be being offered to the Nigerian government to free the over 200 schoolgirls captured by Boko Haram.
Someone nearly died. Hey, someone just died. Hey, police, they come, army, they come. Hey, confusion everywhere. Hey, 7 minutes later, all done cool down, brother. Police don't go away. Army don't disappear. Them leave sorrow, tears, and blood.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Eliza Griswold, who's a fellow at the New America Foundation, a poet and author of the New York Times bestseller, The Tenth Parallel, Dispatches from the Fault Line Between Islam and Christianity. Her latest book is I Am the Beggar of the World, Land Days from Contemporary Afghanistan. And she has an article at Slate Magazine, Why Fear Boko Haram? Welcome to Background Briefing, Eliza Griswold.
Thank you very much for having me.
And you, in your first book, The Tenth Parallel, Dispatches from the Fault Line Between Islam and Christianity, you write about your run-in with Boko Haram, which was incredibly frightening, and you're lucky to have survived it. And as you point out in your article at Slate, you wouldn't have survived it in the contemporary situation, since this happened back in 2007, where they nearly killed a Nigerian reporter with you. And you only escaped after a local elder got you into a car and drove you away. Describe what happened. How did you meet with them? And what was that, the impression of these people? Because we've seen the video of the leader of Boko Haram talking about selling the girls off as slaves, the 200-plus girls that he's seized. So describe your experiences with Boko Haram.
Sure. So Abu Bakr Shekau, who's currently the leader of Boko Haram, was not yet the leader. At that time, a man named Muhammad Yusuf, who was killed by security forces in 2009, was the leader of Boko Haram. And I went to Maiduguri, the main town in the northeast that calls itself sort of the capital now, or Boko Haram really cites Maiduguri as the capital of a lot of their activities. I went to Maiduguri to meet with the group. They were they're still shadowy, obviously, but they were little known at that time. They had been known as Africa's Taliban. They had called themselves that. And they were developing into a hardcore militant group that claimed to want an end to Western education. They hadn't yet begun attacking schools, which they have over the past few years. Of course, we see now exactly how far they'll go. Not only will they kill children who are watching a soccer match, they will burn, they'll lock kids inside schools, set those schools on fire, and exactly as you just said, they just took more than 200 girls, and today it looks like they've taken about 10 more.
And it does seem that the Nigerian government is somewhat helpless or inept, and also, I mean, clearly corrupt, and it's really very distressing to learn that the Nigerian First Lady, Goodluck Jonathan's wife, she was blaming the women who were sitting in protest, claiming that they were with Boko Haram and had them arrested. So what's your understanding of the nature of this government and why it is that, apart from apparently ineptitude, why is it that they can't address this issue or even, you know, allow this thing to happen? This kidnapping took place over many, many hours. and since then apparently haven't really done much, except now they have to do something because of international pressure and embarrassment.
The government is not only inept, the terrain that they are attempting to... The terrain, the Sambi Forest, into which the girls were taken, is an incredibly difficult area to access. Now, that certainly gives absolutely no quarter or excuse to the ineptitude and inactivity by Nigerian security forces, who claimed after the first phase of the raid that they had rescued more than 100 of the girls, which was an odd thing to claim. That was the spokesman for the Nigerian military, as they hadn't rescued a single one. So the ineptitude is ineptitude in itself. It's also born, the divisions between the north and the south of the country are born out of long-standing differences, ethnic and otherwise, that predate independence. So the south, where Goodluck Jonathan is from the south of the country, the south's interest in the north and insecurity and stability in the north has always been low, and at this time it's at an all-time low.
So, in effect, you're talking about this fault line between Islam and Christianity, are you not?
Absolutely. What we're seeing is this very pronounced fault line that lies roughly between the equator and the line of latitude 10 degrees to the north, the 10th parallel. And along that fault line, across most of inland Africa, two religions meet, Islam and Christianity. And in the Muslim north, along this fault line, there are, in Nigeria in particular, but in other nations as well, but Nigeria is probably the strongest example right now, there is a real disenfranchised population. And for many of the Muslims of northern Nigeria, Islam has become a kind of rallying cry, an anti-colonial, anti-Western rallying cry. Let's return to a time where there wasn't corruption, where the government was pure, where we had our needs met. And of course, you know, the government in Nigeria is so corrupt that despite being one of the world's largest suppliers of oil, the average Nigerian lives on less than $2 a day and doesn't have a right to the most basic services as supplied by the government. That means there's no such thing as free schooling. And that's really where we see Boko Haram spring from. We see a massive, we're talking more than 20 million young, mostly men, in northern Nigeria who go without any kind of schooling at all. Traditionally, there was a form of Islamic schooling that was for free called al-Majri schooling. And that used to be a pretty legitimate way to get an education. And the boys of the north would travel to teachers' farms, and along those farms, they would, in exchange for an education, they would work on the farm. Well, what's happened, really along this belt, along the 10th parallel, as a result of climate pressure, those farms, those Islamic farms teachers used to run, can no longer run because the southern spread of the desert. Because the Sahara is spreading south as a result of desertification, the teachers can no longer run these schools on that farmland. And they move south, they move to the edges of slums, they move to cities. And so the kids who were getting an Islamic education now work for the teachers still, but they work as beggars. And they form a ready army when any political leader needs to kind of hire out a mob. And this really is the roots of the foot soldiers of Boko Haram.
Well, of course, what though is this phenomenon? It seems to be rife in Africa of kidnapping children, using them as sex slaves, and also using them as child soldiers. I mean, you've got the case of Joseph Kony in the Lord's Resistance Army. You know that I hesitate to call that guy a Christian, but he nominally a Christian. So it's not entirely to do with Islam, is it? I mean, what explains? Is there any cultural explanation apart from poverty and ignorance that one would, you know, abuse, rape, kidnap, murder, and terrorize children into becoming child soldiers?
And, you know, it's not just Africa with the phenomenon of child soldiers. One of the places that we've seen child soldiers used quite a lot in the past, let's say 20 years, would be in Central and South America. among, you know, rebel groups like the FARC, I'm thinking in Colombia. So it's not an African phenomenon as much as it's a phenomenon of poverty and lack of absolute any form of good governance, any form of civil society, so that for people to allow their children to be armed, to work as child soldiers, I mean, if you have a gun, at least you're going to eat. And that is a lot of the thinking. Now, the degree to which Boko Haram has taken its example of the mass kidnap of girls from Joseph Kony's Lord's Resistance Army is a curious question. Boko Haram is looking to make an international mark. They are looking to be taken seriously as a terrorist organization. Because the Lord's Resistance Army is currently, the United States has, you know, one of our military objectives in Africa is to kill or capture Joseph Kony, who many years ago took, you know, more than 100 girls from a boarding school in northern Uganda. So the historic echoes are strong here. Whether or not Boko Haram was looking expressly at those echoes in order to poke at the West, in order to wake the United States, is a question. I think it's much more likely that Boko Haram was continuing their pattern of trying to perpetuate the things that they don't have when they're stuck in the jungle, which is sex and help with labor, namely cooking. So the girls are literally, you know, are literally sex slaves and cooks, because those are the skills that the men cannot take care of themselves in the jungle where they are, in the Zambezi forest.
So, Elizabeth Griswold, what do you make then of the U.S. sending teams in response to this kidnapping and the apparent inability of President Goodluck Jonathan's government to do much about it? Obviously, they're not sending troops in, but they're sending in, obviously, some intelligence assets, and it's a little vague. And obviously, the Nigerians don't want to, their pride would be such they wouldn't want to admit the extent to which they're being helped out by foreigners, I imagine. So what's your reading on what the U.S. could be doing in response to a conversation that Secretary of State Kerry had with President Goodluck Jonathan?
You know, I don't want to get into too much supposition about the U.S. role in Nigeria vis-a-vis the search for Boko Haram. Suffice it to say that we do have, the United States does have, you know, between 3,000 and 5,000 soldiers on the ground right now in Africa. And we do move those assets around as need be from place to place. So it's not new for the United States to have a military presence in Africa, nor is it new to go to the aid of countries that are having internal struggles. So that much is not new. And then that's about as much as I know, so that's as much as I can say.
Well, I spoke the other day with a Nigerian who's been banned from Nigeria. He runs SaharaReporters.com. And he also has been threatened. The Boko Haram have threatened to blow up his office in New York. So he's getting it from both sides. One of the things that he was suggesting was that this camp where these girls are being held is not mysterious. It's quite well known that the Nigerian authorities know about it. Is that your understanding?
That is my understanding, yes.
So what's kind of theatres going on here now?
You know, I think it's a little bit more complicated in that it's not as easy. We've seen this over the years, certainly with the U.S. military presence in Afghanistan and along the border with Pakistan. Just knowing where somebody is certainly doesn't solve all the problems of how to get to them. I would be the last person to make an excuse for the Nigerian military or its security forces. But the truth is, it's not as easy as it looks to conduct an operation against any terrorist organization, let alone Boko Haram. And the stakes of going in and shooting their way in would be to kill these girls as well. So I don't think it necessarily implies some kind of massive cover-up or conspiracy that the Nigerians' ineptitude has made them unable to care enough to go after the girls. I don't think there's more to it than that.
Well, in terms of the deal, though, that the government made with MEND, the group down in the Delta that were frustrating oil shipments and having illegal bush refineries and tapping into pipelines, etc., and driving around in speedboats and with bandoliers and bullets and lots and big heavy machine guns, etc. My understanding is that the Nigerian government made a deal with MEND and literally paid them off.
And
there's no comparison between MEND and Boko Haram.
Right.
So, MEND was a bunch of thugs wanting money.
Right.
Boko Haram is a very, very dangerous terrorist organization that has absolutely no interest in creating any kind of long-term arrangement with the Nigerian government or any other. They are looking to create an international presence for themselves as an al-Qaeda-like organization.
So they're not angling for a price, a payoff?
Oh, I'm sure they're angling for a price and a payoff, but they're not angling from the Nigerian government for it, and they won't be anytime soon.
So this is really a fight to the death then, is it? I mean...
Yep. I would say that's a safe thing to say. I mean, it depends who you talk to. It depends the level of support you think that Boko Haram garners in the north. There are certainly elements. Do I think that a fight to the death is going to be profitable? No. Do I think that negotiation with Boko Haram should be on the table? I absolutely do, because I don't know that there's going to be any other way to reach these guys without real civilian casualties.
Well, I recall seeing some time back, Eliza Griswold, a video that Al Jazeera was playing of Nigerian soldiers and the military having captured a bunch of, they looked like ordinary villagers, men, who they made laid prostrate on the ground. You know, they were just randomly shooting them. And then one guy admired one of the prisoners' hats and put it on and then shot him. And it was quite disturbing. So what is the level of professionalism in this army? Is there any?
You know, it's a too big question to answer. There's the level of ineptitude at the lower levels is extremely high. There are some groups within the Nigerian military that are extremely highly trained by both Navy, the U.S. Navy SEALs, as well as British Special Operations. There's a group called the Small Boat Service that operates in the south. They have become much more effective. They're in the north now fighting against Boko Haram. There's a lot of pieces from which to look at the Nigerian military.
But in terms then of this fault line that we've talked about with the Muslim north and the Christian south, is there any way to mend that? Or is it, are we talking about a country that should, in fact, divide? Or
no, Nigeria shouldn't divide. I mean, it doesn't have sort of a cogent south and a cogent north. It's a federal, it's made up of 36 states. It's a federal system that is fairly, in terms of being a federal system and distributing, at least in name, having the system set up to distribute wealth. One of the reasons we haven't seen more rage in the north generally against the south is that oil revenues do reach the north as well. So there's widespread endemic corruption in both north and south. Many of the oil-rich states in the south have a higher level of corruption, but it's not as if the north is utterly impoverished while the south flourishes. So the fault line is pronounced. It's growing more pronounced, not only in Nigeria, but across it. A lot of what we've seen in Central African Republic, certainly in Sudan, and across, you know, Ethiopia, as well as some of the tensions between Ethiopia and Somalia, have pieces interlinked with this religious fault line, across which the majority of Christians and Muslims in Africa meet. But whether the solution to that fault line is simply to divide countries religiously, the answer is no. So the solution lies in good governance. It lies in cleaning up corruption. It lies in supplying basic services for everything from electricity to school in rural communities across that belt. And with the increasing GDPs that we see across Africa and the explosive growth of capital and the possibilities for deeper emerging markets, that's really what we see as a solution across most of Africa. And, you know, without that, I should go.
Okay, well, I'm just going to say that they're about to have a World Economic Forum on Africa in Nigeria. And the head of the central bank there recently revealed between $30 and $50 billion have gone missing, and he got fired. So it sounds like there needs to be a better distribution of wealth, to put it mildly.
Yeah, The corruption endemic on every level of Nigerian government is stunning. And until Nigeria is able to address that problem itself, solutions that address the root causes of what creates groups as disparate as Mend and Boko Haram will be impossible to come by.
Thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Eliza Griswold, who's a fellow at the New America Foundation, a poet and author of the New York Times bestseller, The Tenth Parallel, Dispatches from the Fault Line Between Islam and Christianity. Her latest book is I Am the Beggar of the World, Land Days from Contemporary Afghanistan, and she has an article at Slate Magazine, Why Fear Boko Haram. We're going to take a brief station break and back talking to a veteran foreign service officer at the State Department on the need for a diplomatic effort to prevent a war in Ukraine. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Peter Van Buren, who's a 24-year veteran foreign service officer at the State Department who spent a year in Iraq leading two State Department provincial reconstruction teams. He wrote about it in We Meant Well, How I Helped Lose the Battle for the Hearts and Minds of the Iraqi People. Following his book, the Department of State began termination proceedings against him, stripping him of his security clearance and diplomatic credentials. Through the efforts of the Government Accountability Project and the ACLU, he instead retired from the State Department with his full benefit. He has a new book, Ghosts of Tom Joad, A Story of the 99%. Welcome to Background Briefing, Peter Van Buren.
Ian, thank you for having me.
And Peter, you, along with a number of former intelligence officers from the National Security Agency and from the CIA, the group of which you are a member, Veterans Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, have written a memorandum to the President of the United States asking him for urgent action on Ukraine and calling for an Obama-Putin summit on Ukraine. Tell me about where that stands. Has that been sent to the White House?
It has, and we're still waiting for Obama to return the call. But I think what's important and why we chose to send this letter advocating for a summit of some kind is that the United States needs to recall that diplomacy is a critical part of its foreign policy and its work overseas. We have seen in both my organization and through simply following the media that more and more America now jumps from step one to step five, immediately going back towards sanctions, immediately invoking the threat of military force, and seems to have forgotten that diplomacy oftentimes, in fact, when it's serious, always involves talking to people who you don't like, who may be your enemies, whose interests are not immediately aligned with yours. That's kind of the whole point of it. And simply to say, well, we don't agree with what Putin's doing, and so therefore we're not going to talk to him, in hopes that should the crisis boil over, we might be able to leave him a voicemail, really isn't the way that foreign policy should be conducted.
Well, the latest from the White House appears to be that they have convinced a number of chief executives of big U.S. corporations not to attend a summit that Putin is putting on for foreign businessmen investing in Russia coming up in a couple of weeks. It effectively puts these executives in a no-win situation. They don't want to offend the White House. At the same time, they don't want to offend Putin, who's likely to cut off their business dealings with Russia. So this is, if this is the best move that we can make, it doesn't sound particularly robust in the sense that I don't see this situation in Ukraine getting any better. It's getting worse. I mean, there's likely to be a full-scale war at any moment. I just don't get the sense of urgency, which I guess is, you know, aside from whether or not Putin has any, you know, we have any leverage over him, short of these sanctions. I just don't get the sense of urgency here that the world community recognizes what a dangerous situation is underway in Ukraine.
It's a very difficult thing to parse out, but looking specifically at America's actions, the things that are coming out of the White House are almost, and I don't mean to be disingenuous, are almost akin to President Obama asking those business executives to unfriend Putin on Facebook. These gestures are symbolic at the very best, oftentimes, as you put it, forcing American businesses into awkward situations that accomplish very, very little. Putin understands that people need to do business with him and with Russia, and is unfortunately playing the game of politics and diplomacy far, far better than anybody here in Washington. It was clear over the Syrian crisis that Putin had been at this a little bit longer than we had. And now again with the Ukraine, the United States has failed to really articulate what its goal is in this situation, other than to stop the Russians from whatever their goal is, and has failed to line up its allies, failed to articulate a strategy, and finds itself just sort of stumbling around in the dark. It's unfortunately far too reminiscent of the early days of the War on Terror, where wars were started and alliances were snubbed in service of goals that were pretty hard to actually discern.
Well, I understand also, in spite of the fact that since 9/11 we've spent some enormous amounts of money on both the Pentagon and on the intelligence services, with all of this privatization and going on, and I don't know what I think the intelligence budget has just gone through the roof. I don't know whether it's been doubled from Cold War levels, but it's huge compared to what it used to be. And yet we learn that Secretary of State John Kerry was completely blindsided by the Putin's invasion of Crimea. So, I mean, what's your sense from the group that you're a part of, Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, that sent this letter to the White House calling for an Obama-Putin summit on Ukraine? What's the sense amongst your colleagues of what we're getting for all of this money we're spending on intelligence? If the Secretary of State doesn't even know what this big move is underway, and he's talking to Lavrov, and meanwhile, you know, suddenly they take Crimea, what does that say about our intelligence capabilities?
It raises some very serious questions, but I think I'm going to suggest something even more serious than perhaps simple incompetence or sloppy work on the intelligence agency's part. So that certainly is something worth considering and probably certainly a factor. And the issue that remains even more troublesome to me is the question of exactly who the intelligence agencies are in fact truly working for and what in fact their mission goals, if you will, are. The intelligence agencies, through the budget process, through the accumulation of information process, have taken a huge chunk of power out of the executive branch in Washington. We all know that the senior official from the United States to kind of sneak into Ukraine just before a lot of bad things start to happen was the head of the CIA. We also know that the intelligence agencies either can vacuum up everything or they can't. But what we don't know really is how they choose to share that information, how it's disseminated throughout the government, and whether that information is being used or manipulated or withheld or parsed out in small bites in ways that can in fact influence American policy and cause certain policymakers to appear stronger in a situation or appear weaker in a situation. It's difficult to forget what happened in Syria earlier this year, when it appeared once again that the United States had very little connection and knowledge of what was going on the ground. The White House flubbed around. Secretary Kerry embarrassed both himself and the United States by handing over the crisis resolution, if you will, to the Russians. Questions are there about how all this is working in Washington and what really is going on behind the scenes. I hesitate to add also the conversation between Victoria Nuland and her ambassador to Ukraine that was apparently recorded by the Russians and broadcast, which showed Nuland and the ambassador planning on how they were going to be manipulating events in the Ukraine, albeit unsuccessfully, and featured Ms. Nuland's famous remark where she suggests that the EU do something to themselves that's anatomically quite rude. That conversation was held on some unclassified Blackberries, unclassified cell phones. Anybody could have taped it. And the fact that the NSA was not monitoring that and trying to intercede or not providing the equipment that was necessary raises again in my mind the question of who's in charge and what's happening to this information that is being vacuumed up.
So when you mentioned Victoria Nuland and the intercepted conversation, first of all, I'm amazed that there's still neocons in the government, and particularly in the Obama administration, after they made such a disgraceful mess of American foreign policy and did so much damage. I know they've infiltrated the national security community fairly effectively, and they certainly have a lot of voices on television. But why in God's name Victoria Nuland is in that position? And furthermore, the critical moment in this whole catastrophe with Ukraine seems to have been when the EU put it to the Ukrainians, you're either with us or with Russia. There's no way that you can – there's any middle ground. They made it a zero-sum situation in offering entry into the EU. And that, of course, prompted Putin then to lean on Yanukovych, saying the same thing: you're either with me or with them. There's no other two ways. And he made it pretty clear that you got to be with Russia. That to me, that kind of a diplomatic blunder that set this whole tragedy in motion. How come nobody on our side noticed that? Least of all Victoria Nuland. She may well have been a part of prompting it.
You're left in these situations with either risking sounding like a conspiracy theorist or risking simply saying that the people who are running America's foreign policy are blatantly incompetent. And I'm not sure which one kind of takes my fancy right now, but let's take a look at both of them. When you go to an extreme as an opening salvo in diplomacy, there's no place to back down from. Throughout my years in the State Department, we had regular sessions and classes and instructions on how to negotiate, how to conduct diplomacy. And the magic word was never put yourself in a corner and never put your opponent in a corner, because there's no more negotiation at that point. You've got to leave the door open so that you can get to your goal one way or the other. At the point where you say it's our way or the highway, then in fact you are requiring your opponent to choose one or the two, and you've just reduced your odds of success to no more than 50%. And so whether that kind of strategy, which, by the way, we've seen over and over again in the Obama administration, whether that kind of strategy reflects a power struggle in Washington between the intelligence agencies and other parts of the executive branch, or whether it represents simple incompetence, I'm not really sure which point of view would actually be worse. I'm tempted to believe that incompetence may be actually more dangerous than a thought-out process. At the same time, as you mentioned in your question, watching America once again plunge down a tunnel driven by neocon black and whiteism frightens me as an American, frightens me as a former diplomat, and leaves me wondering, after the Ukraine, what's next? Where else will we discover a new crisis that has to be resolved again with these hard hammer techniques.
So, Peter Van Buren, the other aspect of this crisis, which has been long in its gestation, has been the eastward movement of NATO. While the EU deal was an economic deal, it wasn't about membership in NATO. The way that Putin and the Russians see it is that they'd end up with NATO on their border, on their western border. They felt that was inevitable, and the Democrats don't want to take that off the table. I interviewed Strobe Talbott, who was Clinton's guy on Russia, who it was part and parcel of all this movement of NATO eastward. It's interesting to note that people like Henry Kissinger are opposed to NATO expansion and offering NATO membership to Ukraine, yet the Democrats are the ones that are encouraging it. So it's a bit strange to me. You know, it looks as if the Democratic hawks are more dangerous than the Republican hawks.
You've created a very odd situation here, Ian, where you're tricking me into agreeing with Henry Kissinger about something. But in fact, I'll have to concede the point to the great man here. The Russians have always, historically, been concerned about foreign armies encroaching on their borders. And NATO during the Cold War was clearly just another manifestation, a hyper-manifestation because of nuclear weapons. The Russians, you asked the question, well, what would a Ukrainian NATO represent? Would that significantly affect the defense of Western Europe? What would be the goal of threatening the Russians into a new move, which would certainly have to happen? I think that you're seeing the results of that kind of pigheadedness about, well, NATO has, or Ukraine has to become part of NATO because the countries to the east of them have become part of NATO, so we're just going to keep marching this thing eastward until, the suburbs of Moscow are members of NATO. It is simply foolish, almost unbelievable to think that those kind of moves by the United States, by the West, could go unanswered by the Russians, particularly being led by a hardliner like Vladimir Putin, who both remembers the old days and is not afraid to use his power and Russia's power in furtherance of his goals. Again, when you back people into corners, you cannot expect anything other than them to try to fight their way out. It's not good diplomacy. It's not smart foreign policy. And I don't think politically it's even a particularly good idea. It's very hard to imagine an outcome in the Ukraine that will make the White House and the Democrats look good going into the midterm elections.
Well, Peter Van Buren, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure, Ian. I'd be happy to come back anytime.
And again, I've been speaking with Peter Van Buren, who's a 24-year veteran Foreign Service officer at the State Department who spent a year in Iraq leading two State Department provincial reconstruction teams. He wrote about it in We Meant Well, How I Helped Lose the Battle for the Hearts and Minds of the Iraqi People. And following his book, the Department of State began termination proceedings against him, stripping him of his security clearance and diplomatic credentials. Through the efforts of the Government Accountability Project and the ACLU, he instead retired from the State Department with his full benefits. And he has a new book, Ghosts of Tom Joad, a story of the 99%. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.